Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the show. You're listening to RMU Radio, and this is Sports Takeover. Matt and Chris with you on this Wednesday night, and we have lots to get to, so let's get started. Playoffs are among us, Chris. NBA and NHL. Let's start with an update on the National Basketball Association.
Well, the Eastern Conference is entirely done with its first round because nobody that is below the four seed apparently likes to give any sort of effort. All four of the series were done in either four or five games, that being that all the lower seeds combined for two wins. Really a pathetic effort from the East, but not unexpected, as it's very much so been top heavy all of the season in the East. I'm going to start with the 1-8, the Milwaukee versus Detroit series. That was a clean sweep for the Bucks. It was no contest whatsoever. They won on average by 23 points per game. It was just men amongst boys, really. But good for Milwaukee. That's their first series win since 2001. So they've definitely been craving a playoff victory like this for a while.
Yeah, not surprising the results, I don't think, from the Eastern Conference first round. Milwaukee did not score fewer than 119 points in any of the four games, while Detroit wasn't able to score more than 104. So really no contest there. You said they won by a margin of 23 per game. The other sweep in the East was Boston over the Pacers. That's the 4-5 matchup, the one that we thought maybe would be a little bit closer, but obviously Indiana is not the same team now that they were at the beginning of the year. Really just, again, not much of a contest. Very low scoring, though. I don't believe Boston scored more than 110 points, so we're seeing scores in the 130s, even the 140s around the association. I'm not sure if Boston will be able to keep up in the next round, but they certainly took care of business in the first round.
Yeah, and actually each game was really close. All four games were less than 10 points or fewer of a margin of victory for Boston, so it's not like they blew Indiana out of the water by any means, but really Indiana didn't have that much of a chance. Like you said, Boston barely didn't score over 110, while Indiana only scored over 100 once. First game was 84-74 Boston, and it was a very low-scoring series. I don't really know how well that's going to be able to keep up when we get to second round when they have to face the Bucks, because clearly the Bucks have their prolific offense and the stingy defense, and it's really a change of pace for Boston having come off of playing Indiana, who clearly is not top without Victor Oladipo on their team. So definitely a change of pace for sure there.
It's going to be a change of pace for all these teams. They really didn't have a whole lot of competition in the first round. You said it, the four teams that lost combined for two wins. It's going to be exciting, I think, to see how these teams adjust to playing other teams that can actually compete with them. I will say, I think had Indiana been a little bit better down the stretch, this could have been advantage Boston. If you're looking at them being the only team that is coming out of the first round with a competitive series, but we really didn't see any competitive series, and so I think it's pretty wide open going into the second round.
Yeah, definitely. And on the other side of the East, we saw the 3-6 matchup was Philadelphia and Brooklyn. Philadelphia won the series in five games. Started off a little bit unexpected. Brooklyn did steal game one, but then Philadelphia, like the three seed they are, just kind of took control and won the next four games. And in the sights of game five, Philadelphia started on a 23-2 run. So if you're Brooklyn, yeah, your face says it all to me right now. If you're Brooklyn, that's not the way that, okay, we're fighting off elimination. We know we're going to do it. We're going to keep them away. And, well, clearly going down 21 in the first quarter is not the way to do that whatsoever.
Holy cow. That's incredible. The other matchup there, Toronto and Orlando, is the same story. The Magic surprised everybody and took game one. Toronto then took the next four, just as Philadelphia did. Again, I guess those were the most competitive series in the East, but not a whole lot to be excited about in the first round on that side of the bracket.
No, definitely not. The Toronto and Philadelphia matchup, though, does seem to be more interesting than the Boston and Milwaukee one, because Milwaukee is clearly the better team of the two. In the season series over Boston, they won 2-1. And last year, Boston actually won 4-3 in the first round against Milwaukee when Milwaukee was not as strong of a team as they are right now. Boston clearly has taken a step back while Milwaukee has taken a step forward. That one, not so great. But Toronto and Philadelphia, these are really two teams that have built themselves to the point that they're at this season. We saw Toronto acquired Kawhi Leonard in that blockbuster trade in the offseason. Clearly, it's paid dividends for Toronto as they've gotten now to the semifinals, where they will not lose to the LeBron-led Cavaliers, finally. After three consecutive years of losing to them, they finally get a reprieve and get to play the Sixers. And the Sixers are a team that is really on the upswing in terms of their whole team success. You know, trust the process. Well, the process is now, last year they had a good playoff performance. Not great, but I think pretty standard for what we've expected last year. This year is the year really they have to take the step forward, or else you kind of have to wonder, okay, what process are we trusting here?
Yeah, this is going to be the test for all four of these teams. I think as soon as LeBron left for Los Angeles, the conversation was immediately, well, the East is wide open. Well, by wide open, we meant one of these four teams, and that's the four teams that we're left with. Toronto took 3 of 4 in the regular season from Philadelphia. I think just with the momentum that either of these teams had coming into the postseason, Toronto's the favorite. Obviously, home court goes to them. I think a little bit of the momentum goes to them, and the experience goes to them with a guy like Kawhi on their side. So I certainly think, and like you said, it's a team that's been close each of the last few years, but of course, the best player at that time in the Eastern Conference stood in their way every time. So I think that's out of the way. I think that they actually, for once, have the experience on their side by a slim margin, but I think it'll be enough that they can get it done, but I think it's going to be a really good series.
Yeah, definitely. It should be a lot more compelling than the first
any of the ones that we've seen so far in the East.
I'm not convinced that the Milwaukee-Boston one will be that close, but Toronto-Philadelphia sounds like it should be an exciting series for sure. Shifting focus to the Western Conference now, whereas the East has all four series done, the West only has one series done as we speak currently. That's Portland-OKC, the 3-6. Both you and I predicted that OKC would win this series as the 6, as they've had Portland's number. Well, the exact opposite of that happened. Portland was able to defeat Oklahoma City in 5 games, and really it was all because of Damian Lillard. He carried that team tremendously, putting up 50 in Game 5 victory last night, where he shot a 3-pointer from the logo at about half court at the buzzer to give the Blazers the playoff series victory. It was really just a remarkable series from Damian Lillard.
Yeah, he's putting up 28.8 points per game, which I believe is tied for the postseason lead with Kevin Durant. A little bit disappointing here. I had OKC actually going 2 rounds. They were the only lower seed that I had some faith in because of the fact that they could actually play on the road. But you said it, Damian Lillard has stepped up big time. And OKC, you know, Paul George and Russell Westbrook, we thought would be a pretty significant duo entering the playoffs, but they only surpassed 100 points in 2 of these games. Obviously, with the exception of the Boston series, we haven't seen any series where 100 points even is going to win you any games. And obviously that shows as they were only able to get 1. So kind of a poor performance from OKC, a little bit disappointing, I think, given the regular season performance from some of their stars that it's over for them this early.
It's bad, too. OKC is a team that had competed. They made a finals a few years ago where they lost to the Heat, with obviously Durant, Harden, and Westbrook on the team. Not quite the players now that they were then. They've each matured in their own directions as they've gone, but still, they were strong back then. And now this is the 3rd straight year they've had a first-round exit. And dating back to 2016, they were up 3-1 in the conference finals against the Warriors. They have gone 4-15 in their last 19 playoff games following that 3-1 series victory because the Warriors came back and won in 7 games. And then the following 3 seasons, they've been eliminated in the first round, each of them. They have not won a game on the road in the last 3 years. It's what is OKC's problem? Why are they not finding the success in the postseason that people think they should have, including you and I?
Yeah, that's the question. I mean, I think you've seen a team that since they lost in the finals, they've gone backwards. And the finals performance wasn't even all that impressive. It was a 5-game series that they lost. So I think you're looking at a team that over the years has had a lot of talent and a lot of potential, and they haven't lived up to it at all. And I don't know, is it time for big changes? Is it not? It's difficult when you have a team like Golden State in your conference because the possibilities of you getting out of the West, regardless of how you're playing, is slim to none. But you said the first round exits are something that, you know, it has to stop, and it almost reminds you a little bit of a Pittsburgh Penguins in the NHL. You know, they had some success, got to some finals, and then from there it was a lot of disappointments, and it took a big overhaul before they returned to the Stanley Cup Finals. So is that where we're at with OKC? I don't know. It's hard to say. The West is good. The West is easily the better of the two conferences.
It's been good too
for years. Yes, it has. And they just haven't really found a way to make much noise.
And especially seeing how they've had Portland's number too. I mean, this is Portland's
right. That was part of the reason that we both had faith in them.
Yeah, I think the season series went 4-0 in advantage of OKC. Some along them lines, they clearly were the better team over Portland as far as that matchup goes, just not this series. And Portland's a team that has not found playoff success either. Since 2000, their playoff series record is 3-11. That includes this first round victory. They've only won the first round 2 other times, and well, obviously, 11 playoff series losses, so they're not a team that is accustomed to success. But because they didn't quite reach the levels that Oklahoma City reached a few years ago, I don't know that expectations are always as high for Portland. See, Portland has Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum, and they're very good players, but they're both underrated. They're not like, okay, it's Russell Westbrook, it's Paul George, they're going to lead their team to glory. No, it's these two guys are good, and Portland will do as good as they do. With Oklahoma City, it's boom or bust almost for them. So for Portland winning this series, it's good for them, and doing it so emphatically in five games shows that maybe they're a force to be reckoned with moving forward.
Yeah, pretty lifeless performance from OKC, and I mean, maybe we judge this loss based on how Portland does, see how they do in the next round, depending on who they play. If it's a first round or a very easy exit for them, then I think there's even more questions about OKC. So it'll be interesting to see what they decide to do moving forward.
Yeah, and the matchup for Portland is still yet to be decided, as they will play the winner of the Denver and San Antonio series, which currently Denver leads 3-2. It's the only series that is definitely at six games, obviously. The sixth game will be played tomorrow night. San Antonio did have control of the series early on. They won the first game. They were up 2-1, but now Denver has stormed back and won the last two games by double digits, where the first three games were all decided by 10 points or less. So Denver kind of seems to be pulling away in this series, but it's still San Antonio. It's still Greg Popovich. And most importantly, Game 6 is in San Antonio.
I'm just happy that we finally have a series where both teams look like they want to play the game. For crying out loud, sweeps all over the place, five games is all it takes. And you talked about other series in the West not being closed out. That's just because they haven't played a fifth game yet. This one is actually competitive, and it's actually enjoyable and worth paying attention to. The rest of them, it's not even worth watching. It's just get me to the second round already. So we finally have a good one. San Antonio in San Antonio has been very good, as we've talked about several times on the show. I would certainly like to think that they'll come out with something to prove at home. But you said it, Denver's kind of pulling away a little bit. Either way, I think it'll be a good game six and actually a good series.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is a 2-7 matchup, so not necessarily one that should be as close as it is. You would expect this one maybe should be over in five. The West isn't as large of a disparity as the East is. I mean, the 2-7 in the East was probably about a 15-game difference, whereas in the West it was less than 10. So the West has teams that are much more closely matched up. And in the regular season, Denver and San Antonio were very close.
Yeah.
I called the series Denver in six from the onset. I'm not sure. Do you remember what you said?
I think I called it in seven.
In seven, yeah. So both of us saw this as a series that was probably going to go longer than some of the others. Clearly, it's lived up to those expectations. The other two series we have yet to mention are two, like you said, they just haven't been finished yet because they haven't played all the games. Golden State is the one playing the Clippers, the eight. They did blow a 31-point lead, but they are up 3-1 in the series. They really haven't looked back either from that 31-point lead they blew in game two. It was only a 4-point margin of victory, too, for the Clippers, but the other two games, it's been all Golden State. So seems to be another easy flyby round for Golden State, apparently.
Yeah, and it really should be. They've put up over 113 points in every game that they've played. It's just an offense that is difficult to stop. We've seen it for years now. The Clippers are seeing it up close and personal at the moment, and I don't know that they really are going to have an answer for that. They had an answer in one game. They have it in the other three. I don't see them having an answer moving forward. Golden State's a tough team to match up with, and I don't see the Clippers as being the team that can do it.
No, definitely not. And the last series that go on in the West is Houston versus Utah. Currently, Houston has a 3-1 lead in that, all thanks to James Harden, really. But even Chris Paul has been playing very good complimentary to him. Donovan Mitchell did have a very good game four to help Utah not get swept, but it still seems to be Houston in control definitively. I don't see Houston losing a 3-0 lead in this series. Could Utah maybe win game five? Yes. I find it very hard for them to come back, though. It seems to be Houston's lock.
I could see Utah making a little bit of noise. I had this as a 7-game series before it started. Whether or not that happens after they went down 3-0, is, you know, that's tough, but they've kind of built some momentum here the last few games. James Harden is not playing as well as he was earlier. I think he started game three, I think it was, 0-15 or something.
Yeah, he went 3-20 in the game as well from the field.
So he's kind of gone cold a little bit, and obviously Houston relies on him big time. So it was an even season series, I believe, in the regular season. I think Utah can make a little bit of noise, but I think at the end of the day, it'll still be Houston's series to lose.
Yeah, definitely. So East is all done. West is starting to wrap up the first round. We'll have more coverage on the second round next week. Now we move into the more interesting playoff structure. That is the NHL, where anything goes. Seeds and records make no difference. Throw names in a hat, pick out one, because you're bound to pick out the winner from that theory. No team has an advantage whatsoever. We're going to start in the West with the one overall. It's Calgary. They played Colorado. Should have been an easy series for Calgary. This is their year to make it back to the Cup. Well, it's their year to fall flat on their faces as they lost in five games to the Avalanche after going up 1-0 in the series on a shutout behind Mike Smith. I, along with, I'm sure, many others thought, okay, Calgary, they're for real. This is their year finally. They're going to, you know, go past the first round, get past the second round even. They have a shutout against the 8 seed. They're doing what they should. Well, they lost the next four, and they showed very little effort in games 3 and 4, as Colorado was able to amass over 50 shots in each of those games. And in the series, Colorado was able to pull out two overtime victories. So where Calgary lost all the fight they had, Colorado gave it all they had, thanks to Nathan MacKinnon, large in part.
Yeah, Colorado's been very impressive, and I think I had more faith in them than most did. I had this as a 7-game series, of course, going in favor of the Flames, and that's not an option anymore. But the Avalanche looked like a team that are here to play, and based on what we saw at the beginning of the season, when their top line is on, they're one of the best, arguably the best line in hockey, and this team becomes all the more dangerous. And Nathan MacKinnon's been good. Mika Rantanen's been good. Landis Cog's been good.
All great.
They've all played very well, and Grubauer on the back end has been solid in net. So I think this Colorado team could be dangerous.
Yeah, especially whenever they're able to hold Calgary's top line to 5 points across the three of them. That's
another very good top line.
Absolutely. Calgary's top line competes with the best of them. They don't get the best record in the West just by sheer luck. They have the skill players there. And I think the reason that you said seven, and I might have been even a little apprehensive of saying a sweep, was because their goaltending situation isn't the most ideal. When Mike Smith is good, he's very good. But when he's bad, well, he's very bad. And clearly this series showed many of the holes that Mike Smith had in this team. But really, when your top line only produces 5 points for you, it's hard to compete with Colorado, especially when their top line was as strong as it was.
Yeah. They will play San Jose, who had an incredible game last night.
Amazing.
Against the Vegas Golden Knights. Late in the game, 3-0 they were down. 5-minute major to Cody Eakin of the Golden Knights, and the Sharks put up 4 goals on that 5-minute power play.
I've never seen anything like that before in my life.
That building was losing its mind, as it should have been. 4 goals in 5 minutes to take the lead. The Golden Knights, however, come back with less than a minute to play, equalize the game.
While they had their goalie pulled as well.
Yes, the goalie was pulled.
It was insane.
And then finally, the Sharks pulled it out in overtime. But my goodness, what a third period. What a game and a fantastic series. The Sharks were down 3-1. And again, 3-0 in game 7. I think we were prepared to sit down on the show and talk about the disappointments that they've had over the year. And instead, we're talking about how fantastic they played last night. So San Jose is moving on. Vegas put forth a very good effort, but these are two good teams, and San Jose came out on top.
I'm just stunned by how this whole series went as a whole, especially Game 7. When Vegas went up 3-1 in the series behind a shutout for Marc-Andre Fleury, I said, okay, this is the Vegas team I saw make the Cup final last year. They might have been a little bit shakier in the regular season, but now they have the pieces put together. That second line with Pacioretty and Mark Stone and Paul Stastny was doing prolific things for them. Mark Stone had a hat trick, and then they just kind of fell apart. And really, it was because Martin Jones stood on his head, large in part, because in the first few games, he was not good. He was worse than Mike Smith was. It was bad for San Jose. It was, like you said, we were talking about yesterday, how we would have said, okay, what does San Jose do from here now? You're going to stick with Martin Jones? Well, obviously, you have to if you're playing a second round of the playoffs, don't you? It's incredible. And Game 6 was really Martin Jones' shining glory.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a 2-1 overtime or double overtime victory for San Jose. Vegas amassed 59 shots on Martin Jones, and he turned all but one away in just a effort that San Jose fans will remember for a while. And in Game 7, after they went to overtime, it was not Joe Pavelski, it was not Brent Burns or Erik Karlsson. No, it was Barkley Goodrow, who had only played 6 minutes in regulation, had the fresh legs in overtime to get past the whole Vegas defense and wrap it around Fleury. And it was a wonderful goal, actually, too. But just from an unlikely source.
You just never know in the playoffs who it's going to come from. I'm excited for the second round matchup. These are two hot teams right now, capable of very good things, and I think it's going to be a really exciting series.
Absolutely. On the other side of the West, another series that is surprising from some circumstances, just when you look at where they finish in the standings, it comes from the Central Division. The first matchup was Nashville and Dallas, where Nashville won the division, Dallas was the wild card. But once again, like I said, throw numbers and records away, names, anything makes no difference because Dallas was able to knock off Nashville in six games. Nashville was up 2-1 in the series too, and then Dallas just took over the end thanks in large part to Ben Bishop, because over the course of the final three games, Ben Bishop only conceded five goals, which obviously that's good for Dallas and just not going to get the job done for Nashville.
This is another team that I think I'm higher on than most people are. I have the Stars in the Stanley Cup final, and at this point, that's looking pretty good with some of these other teams not, some of the popular picks not being
in the... Yeah, they're dropping like flies.
Yeah, they're not in contention anymore. But no, I think they showed what they can do when they're firing on all cylinders. And Ben Bishop, a 189 goals against average and a 945 save percentage, that'll win you a lot of series. And Nashville prides themselves on their defense. These games were very close. Four of them were one-goal games, very low scoring. Battle of the defenses, and Ben Bishop and the Stars won.
And ironically enough, you said Nashville prides themselves on defense. Well, the Game 6 went to overtime where John Klingberg, defenseman for Dallas, was the one that actually scored the game-winning goal, too. So it's funny just because Nashville's been known for their defense the last 2 to 3 seasons, and it was a Dallas defenseman that was able to knock off the Predators, which I actually picked Dallas in this series. I was high on them as well, mostly because I just wasn't high on Nashville. They did not play good hockey going down the stretch, whereas Dallas was really competing for that wild card hard. I mean, it was close for most of the season, as we discussed, but they pulled away as that number one wild card towards the end. So clearly they had what it took to win round one. Another team that had what it took was the St. Louis Blues, who was able to knock off the Winnipeg Jets also in six games. But it was a little bit of a comeback for St. Louis. They were up 2-0 in the series after winning the first two on the road. Winnipeg then took the next two on the road, so it was evened up at 2-2. And then in Game 5, Winnipeg was up 2-0 in the third period when St. Louis said, hold on. I think it's our turn to do something really good. And they scored three goals in the last period, including the game-winning goal by Jaden Schwartz with 15 seconds left. And he just didn't stop scoring as he scored a hat-trick in the game-winning Game 6 for the Blues. So really, it was good work from Jaden Schwartz and Binnington as they were able to propel the Blues into the second round.
Yeah, another incredibly close series. Five of the six games were one-goal contests. So two very evenly matched opponents there. 1-5 was the record of the home teams, which is kind of strange, especially when you look at Winnipeg and the whiteouts that they have and how well-known they are for their crowd. So it was kind of a surprise, I thought, that the home team struggled so much, but the Blues ultimately got the lone home win in Game 6 to clinch the series.
Yeah, Winnipeg went 0-3 on at home ice. That's bad.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible. But looking forward, you know, we talked about Dallas and their battle of the goalies, battle of the defenses against Nashville. It's going to be the same thing coming up against Jordan Binnington. He's been what the Blues have lived by, really, since he took over the net. And he's got his work cut out for him with Ben Bishop on the other side. I think this is going to be another exciting, low-scoring, close series.
And one thing's for sure, whoever comes out of the West, it's going to be a goaltending battle for sure because, like you said, Binnington and Bishop, they're, you know, at the top of the line as far as goalies in the playoffs go right now. Pekarinen is also up there, but his team's knocked out. Martin Jones had to help lift his team, and Philip Grubauer's had questions surrounding what he's going to do, so all these guys have been strong in the net for their respective teams in the first round. Which two can take that to the second round and help propel our teams forward? Be very interesting to see. Moving into the East, we already talked about Tampa Bay and Pittsburgh shortcomings last week, so no need to revisit that disgusting place. Instead, we're going to go to excitement of Game 7s, and we're going to start in the Atlantic Division, where, once again, it was Boston, it was Toronto, it was a first-round matchup, it went to Game 7, and Matt, how did it turn out like it did every other time they played this?
Not so good for the Toronto Maple Leafs. They fall 5-1 to the Boston Bruins. I believe it's the third straight matchup against the Bruins that they've lost.
In seven games too, three times.
Yeah, it's tough. Toronto's a really talented team, young team, and it's hard to get going as a young team when you keep getting stuck with the same opponent in the first round. It's one of the things I don't like about this playoff format. As entertaining as it is to see these rivalries grow, it kind of gets old watching the same teams play each other. And I get that to win the cup, you have to be able to beat whoever, you know, you get stuck playing against. But Toronto obviously has a tough time with the Boston Bruins, and because of that, they haven't really been able to get any traction in the playoffs.
Yeah, absolutely. Six straight playoff series that Boston has played Toronto, and Boston has had the upper hand, including three of the last four appearances for the Maple Leafs. It's gone to seven games, and I'm just thankful that I'm not a member of Toronto's media or Toronto's fan base, because they are livid, and honestly, for good reason. This was supposed to be the year they took a step forward. They made the big free agency acquisition of John Tavares in the offseason. They actually had fewer points this season than they did last season, and once again, a first-round exit. So how are you going to, you know, pull out all the stops for Tavares and not advance? They gave William Nylander that monster contract. They have Mitch Marner looming. But I think my, along with many others, biggest question is Mike Babcock. What's his deal? They showed a stat last night during the game that in the last 5 years, his team has had a postseason lead in the first round, in a round. All five of those times, his team has lost. So Mike Babcock has been labeled as a good coach. He received an enormously lucrative deal when he signed with them. But really, to what extent is Mike Babcock the answer for the Maple Leafs? Because he only had one cup with the Red Wings, which had a lot of great players on it. Obviously, he was the coach, but it was a very talented Red Wings team. But since then, it's really been for Mike Babcock.
I still think he's the answer. I think you have to keep in mind that towards the end of his tenure with Detroit, that was a team that was significantly on the downward spiral. I think it was a team that even probably some of those years, there was a surprise that they were even in the playoffs.
That's
so
a fair point.
I don't know that that is indicative of what kind of coach he is. And for Toronto, yeah, the expectations are high, but you know, the people in Toronto aren't going to accept this as an excuse, but there are other teams in the Eastern Conference in the Atlantic Division with high expectations, and Boston is one of them. Regardless of who lost this series, you're going to be questioning, well, we made these moves, we had this expectation, why didn't it work? Because you're playing another very good hockey team. I think there are plenty of teams that Toronto could have beat. I think they don't need to make big changes. I think it's still a learning curve for them, and they're growing as a young team, and I think eventually, without making any crazy moves, they'll find their breakthrough.
You sound much more optimistic than many of the reports I read. I saw a comment from Boston that their penalty kill specifically, they said that they were surprised they did not see Toronto's top power play unit more often. That's kind of alarming whenever, you know, you obviously expect the top power play unit to be out there 70% of the time in the postseason. They're the ones that are supposed to get the job done for you. And in Game 7, you want your best players on the ice for more than they should be on there. Auston Matthews had 18 minutes and 48 seconds of ice time, including only 6 minutes in the third period. So if you're Mike Babcock and you having the opposing team question your coaching methods, there's obviously always been questions about, is Frederik Andersen solid enough? One of the things that was noted was that having Halak and Rask helped Rask be better in the playoffs because he didn't have to play so much, whereas Andersen kind of was relied on too heavily in the regular season for Toronto. So while Boston had the answers, definitely some questions for Toronto and their coaching decisions moving forward.
Yeah, you're right. Final series here in the NHL is in progress right now, Game 7 between the Washington Capitals and the Carolina Hurricanes. This has been a very tight series in the sense that the home team has taken every game. We saw Washington jump up early, Carolina matched them, and then it's been every other game since. So right now, Washington has a 2-0 lead at the end of the first period. Obviously, in their own building, this is kind of what we've seen so far in this series. But I certainly think that there's plenty of hockey still to be played. This has been a really exciting series, though. Something about the Canes is just very intriguing and exciting to watch. And, of course, the Caps are the defending champions, so all eyes are on them as well. I think this has been the series I expected it to be.
Yeah, I actually picked Carolina to win the series in 5 games. I might have been stretching
a little bit, yeah.
But still, I had good faith in Carolina. They were a strong team in the regular season, an interesting team, though, very unique in their own right, the way that they had their storm surges at the end that got their fans rallied together and
kind of got the
players rallied together. Yeah, they were a team that I didn't have high expectations for going into the season. I believe you thought they were going to make the postseason.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really see them as a playoff team, but clearly they presented themselves as one. The one X factor they do have, despite being down 2-0, is Justin Williams.
Mr. Game 7.
Absolutely. He is 7-1 in his Game 7 history with 7 goals, 7 assists, and that's for a total of 14 points in 8 games. So if there's anyone you want on your team for Game 7, it's Justin Williams. His one loss came with the Capitals 2 years ago to the Penguins in 7 games, but he was 7-0 up until that point, so he's certainly a good guy to have. Being down 2-0 after the first, it's kind of rough for them. And like you said, the home team has won each game, so clearly by that logic, Washington should win this game. But the fact that Carolina was able to push the defending champion to the brink of 7 games in the first round, it really shows the efforts that Carolina has grown in the last 10 years since their last playoff appearance, for sure.
Yeah, it's been a very good effort by an inexperienced team against the defending champs, and it should be an exciting end to this series and to the first round.
Absolutely. So first round will conclude tonight. Next week we'll have more talk about the second round, what's going on with that. But first round in the NHL will conclude tonight. And right now we conclude the first half of our show by taking a quick break. But coming up, we have two of our rotating segments that we like to include. So please stay tuned.
Welcome back to the show, Sports Takeover with Matt and Chris. Time now for Top Takeover. Obviously, we've been covering the postseason, so we thought we would take a look at postseasons of past and come up with the top individual postseason performances. So starting with number five, Chris, who do you have?
I am going to start in the NHL. But by the way, this is between the NHL and the NBA.
Yes, because that is correct.
Those are the active postseasons. We might do an MLB and NFL one in the future, but for now it's about the NBA and NHL, and I'm going to start in the NHL. It's at home with the Pittsburgh Penguins in 2009. Evgeny Malkin put on a show for all the NHL. He was the Conn Smythe winner in that Penguins Cup run. He had 36 points, 14 goals, 22 assists in 24 games. Only Paul Coffey, Mario Lemieux and Wayne Gretzky have had more than 36 points in a postseason. So when you're in the same company as those guys are, it's very good for you. He's had the most points since the salary cap era in the postseason. Evgeny Kuznetsov had 32 last year, so he got a little bit close. But Malkin, 36 in one season, led the Penguins tremendously well. He also had 51 penalty minutes that season, so in the postseason. So he clearly was missing some vital time on the ice being in the sin bin, but nevertheless, 36 points, really remarkable, so he's number five on my list.
Yeah, that's a good pick, especially in this era when goals aren't as frequent as they used to be. 36 is quite the total. My number five will also be a Pittsburgh Penguin, but it is not Gino. It is Mario Lemieux in 1991 when he helped the Penguins win their first Stanley Cup and his first of two Conn Smythe trophies. He put up 44 points, 16 goals, and 28 assists. That is the second highest total ever in the postseason. It was a very different era, but regardless, an impressive point total. He did it in 23 games. He contributed shorthanded goals, power play goals. He was all over special teams. 10 points higher than the second best on his team, which says a lot about him, his dominance en route to the Stanley Cup. He missed 54 games in the regular season, which I think makes the postseason run all the more impressive. But my number five is Mario Lemieux with 44 points.
Yeah, when he's not playing barely 30 games in the regular season and to do as well as he did in the postseason, it's incredible because you would expect a guy coming off injury not to be so hot. Mario said, nope, I got it, coach. My number four is going to move into the NBA. It's going to be with the San Antonio Spurs and Tim Duncan in 2003. He was able to put up 24.7 points per game, 15.4 rebounds, and 3.3 blocks as he was able to help lead San Antonio to the title that year. They were able to knock off the Lakers in the second round. That was a Lakers team that had Shaq and Kobe, had been coming off three straight finals victories. So clearly it was an excellent Lakers team, but Duncan was really able to get it done. And in the finals, he did even better than he did during the rest of the postseason, had 24.2 points per game, 17 rebounds per game, 5.3 assists to go with 5.3 blocks. Anytime the Nets were throwing the ball up there, it was getting swatted down by Duncan's paw. He had a 20-20-10 game with 8 blocks, almost a quadruple-double. 2 blocks away, very impressive. So my number four is Tim Duncan.
My number four is also Tim Duncan, the exact same postseason. I don't have a whole lot to add to that. He also added 5 assists per game throughout the postseason. That quadruple-double that he almost put together would have been the first in NBA playoff history. And that 2020-10 was the first in the 27 finals. So all the more impressive from him there. He had averaged 10 more points per game than any other player on the team at that time. Obviously, some other now big names weren't so big at the time.
Yeah, it was a young Spurs team.
Yes, it was. And you talked about them knocking off the Lakers. They also knocked off the 60-win Dallas Mavericks. So a very impressive postseason for them and for Tim Duncan.
Moving ahead to number three, I'm going to go back to the NHL. It's the great one, Wayne Gretzky, 1985. He did what nobody else has ever done in postseason history, putting up 47 points in a mere 18 games. Now, if I told you he had 17 goals in 18 games, you'd say that's ridiculous because people don't score a goal a game, and I would agree with you. The fact that he was able to couple 30 assists with that 17 goals is just mind-boggling. 47 points in 18 games, that's over 2 points per game. It's insane.
It's unheard of anymore.
It's a record that will not be broken ever unless a team manages to play 28 games in the finals, because that's the maximum a team can play that can, even if you lose, that's the maximum a team can play is 28. But I don't think anybody's ever going to touch this record. Just what he did back then. I mean, but goalies back then were basically putting 2x4s on their legs for pads, so much easier to score, but still dominance unheard of at that era. So he's my number three.
Dominance for sure. My number three is still in the NBA. It's in 1994, and it's Hakeem Olajuwon. He won the NBA.
Hakeem the Dream.
That's right. He won the NBA Finals and MVP with the Houston Rockets and really did so pretty single-handedly. 28.9 points per game, a little bit lower than some that you might see on a list similar to this, but the next closest on his team was 13.8.
Oof.
He really took over, 11 rebounds per game, 4.3 assists, and 4 blocks. Only player to average 4 blocks in a finals run. So very impressive run there. He scored more than 20 points in 22 of the 23 games. And 2 times he put up 40 points in the finals, led his team in almost every category. Offensive rebounds per game was the only one that he didn't lead his team in. And he played on average 43 minutes per game throughout the postseason. So a lot of performances over the years on really good teams. This one was a pretty solid individual performance. That's why Hakeem Olajuwon is my number three.
Yeah, being 15 points a game higher than the next closest guy on your team.
It's pretty incredible.
Shows how much the team he really put on his back to get that performance. It's incredible. My number two is going to go into the NBA as well. It is with the 2016 Cleveland Cavaliers and, of course, the one and only LeBron James. Helped bring Cleveland their first title ever over Golden State, the 73-win Golden State Warrior team. That's why I had it so high at number two on my list. LeBron in the playoffs had 26.3 points per game, 9.5 rebounds, 7.6 assists. So not too far away from a triple-double. But after going down 3-1 in this final series to the Warriors, LeBron in the last three games averaged 36.3 points per game, 11.7 rebounds, and 9.7 assists. And most notably, everybody remembers Game 7, the block he had in the closing minutes of the game that really helped keep Cleveland ahead, because at that point, it was really anyone's game, but that block sealed the deal for them. Got Cleveland their first title, got him a finals MVP, so he is number two on my list.
Yeah, that's a good pick. Kyrie Irving was the only reason that I didn't have that one on my list, but you're right, that's very impressive. My number two is coming from a player who didn't actually win a championship the year that he had this incredible performance. Jean-Sebastien Jaeger in 2003 was the goaltender for the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim in their losing effort to the New Jersey Devils. They lost in Game 7 of the final, but he, in a losing effort, won the Conn Smythe as the playoff's most valuable player.
Last player to do that in the NHL, too.
Yeah, it's not something that ever really happens, and I was always confused as to why that happened. Like, surely there was somebody on the Devils that put together a performance that was worthy, but what J.S. Jaeger was able to do is incredible. The first round, he went 4-0, gave up 6 goals, and had a .965 save percentage against the defending champion Red Wings. Second round, he goes 4-2 with a .936 save percentage. In the third round, he goes 4-0, 3 shutouts, and a .992 save percentage. He gave up 1 goal in the sweep. Overall, he finishes 15-6 with a .162 goals against average, a .945 save percentage, and 5 shutouts for the postseason. Almost put him at number one, but my goodness, what a performance by J.S. Jaeger.
And the rest of the Ducks just could not help him out. He was saying, "What more do you want from me?" Now, on the other side of the ice, Martin Brodeur had a very good effort. Obviously, is what helped get them the Game 7 victory, but still, to win Conn Smythe and not even win the cup is remarkable. My number one is a guy who did win Conn Smythe and did win the cup. It's 2012, the Los Angeles Kings and Jonathan Quick. In that postseason, he went 16-4 with a .946 save percentage, 1.41 goals against, and 3 shutouts, all of which were top marks for that postseason. A Kings team that only lost 4 games because Quick was in net for them. He was remarkable. He was not quite the goalie back then that people expected to do so well. He was kind of still early on in his development, but to bring the Kings a cup whenever they were not exactly a super strong team, to get 4 losses against, 3 shutouts, it's just a remarkable performance by Jonathan Quick. He is my number one playoff performance.
I'll tell you, that's not really one that I thought about, but that's a very good pick, a very strong postseason for Jonathan Quick. My number one is one that you've already mentioned. It's Wayne Gretzky. Obviously, he had a lot of help around him in 1985 when he put together that 47-point run, but it's just one of those things that is never going to be matched again. And I think for as impressive as J.S. Jaeger's performance was, Hakeem Olajuwon, Jonathan Quick, other ones that we've mentioned, Wayne Gretzky is untouchable. No one's going to get close to that 47 points. At the time that he scored it, he shattered the previous record of 38, which, by the way, was his own record. So the dominance of Wayne Gretzky was incredible, and it was on full display in 1985. The next closest at that time was 37, was Paul Coffey. So he had his teammates even by a significant margin. Obviously, Mario Lemieux, as I mentioned earlier, was the next closest with 44. But 47 points in 18 games is just something that's probably never, ever going to be done again. And it's good enough for my number one.
Yeah, definitely. So some strong performances from some NBA and NHL players. Will we see something of the likes this postseason? It's a possibility. If Damian Lillard can continue what he's doing, he might contend for a list like this someday. But as of right now, this is where it stands. One last note on those Kings. They were the 8 seed that had to win their final game to make the playoffs and only lost 4 games as the 8 seed, being quote-unquote the worst playoff team in the West. So
incredible run.
Yeah, definitely some good stuff there. That was Top Takeover. Now, another segment that we like to reincorporate back into the show, it's Uncorked. everybody's favorite, where we kind of dive deeper into some little niche subjects that might require some more explanation for some things. This one is going to focus on playoff format. Specifically, in a best of seven series, there are two playoff formats. There is a 2-2-1-1-1, where each number represents the amount of games the team gets at home. So the higher seed gets four games at home, lower seed gets three. 2-2-1-1-1 indicates that the higher seed gets two at home, two away, then they trade home, away, and then home for game seven, versus the 2-3-2, where the higher seed gets two games at home, the lower seed gets three straight at home, and then followed by the higher seed getting two straight at home. So Matt, take over.
Yeah, so this is something that we've talked about in the past during the Major League Baseball postseason, because the MLB is the only league that still incorporates this 2-3-2. Obviously, as we see it now, we're seeing the 2-2-1-1-1, as Chris explained. The NBA also used this method, the 2-3-2, under Commissioner David Stern until about 2013, when Adam Silver changed it to the 2-2-1-1-1. So the very basic arguments in favor of the 2-3-2 reduce travel. Obviously, this is something that the NBA only incorporated in their finals. It's something that they didn't worry about prior to that, because it was Eastern Conference team playing Eastern Conference team. Obviously, you get to the finals and East plays West and there's more travel. So the reason for this change, and the biggest argument in favor of it, is it reduces travel, whether that be expenses, whether it's inconvenience, whatever the case is, rest for the players. That's the argument. In favor of the 2-2-1-1-1, it's fair. The home advantage for a team is that they have more home games than the team that finished with a record that didn't match up to theirs. So obviously in a 2-3-2, you're looking at the team with the quote-unquote advantage plays the first two and then goes on the road for three games. It's not really an advantage, as some people would argue, if a pivotal game five is on the road as a team that is supposed to have the advantage. So basically you're looking at convenience versus fairness in this argument. So in recent history, as I said, the NBA used to deploy the 2-3-2. So there are a couple of examples of this where the 2-3-2, some might argue, worked against the team that should have had the advantage. So in 2011, the Miami Heat had home court advantage in the finals against the Dallas Mavericks. The series was tied 2-2 and going into game five. Well, in a 2-2-1-1-1, that game five, pivotal game five, would have been in Miami because Miami had the advantage. In this case, because of the 2-3-2, it wasn't. It was in Dallas. The Mavericks go on to win that pivotal game five, go up 3-2, and take the series in six games. Another example, the next year, 2012, the Thunder had home court advantage. They were tied 1-1 after the first two games in their own building. Games 3-5 were in Miami. The Heat won all three. Now, that's a little bit different. Game five wasn't as pivotal in the sense that it shifted the momentum, but it was pivotal in the sense that Oklahoma City needed that game to stay alive. Does the end result change if that format is different? Not necessarily, but the fact that they have to play three games on the road is clearly an advantage from Miami, who should not have had the advantage in this series. There are other examples throughout the course of their 2-3-2 implementation where in a 2-2 tie, the home team would win game five, and ultimately the team with home court would take game 6-7, which is technically the way that they draw it up. But obviously, based on these two examples, we've seen that that's not the case.
Yeah, and the big argument is that in the 2-2-1-1-1, if you split the first two games, then it's a best of three where the home team has the advantage, because you want to start the series, you know, best of three off 1-0. Well, when you have to go on the road in that game still, it gives the lower seed an unfair advantage, because now they only have to win one of two games on remaining, whereas the other way around, it's a lot harder for them to go to your building for game five, win that game, and then win another one. I looked at the last 10 years in the NBA postseason, because there's been 5 years of which that there has been the 2-2-1-1-1 format, and 5 years before that where it was still 2-3-2. In the 5 years before that, four of the five times the home team, which was the lower seeded team, won that pivotal game five, which in my opinion, game five is the most important game in a series. Some people might say, yes, game one, you want to get out on the right foot. Well, I think game five is really the one that kind of indicates the direction that the series is going. So four of the five times the home team, which was the lower seed, won that. And then of that, three of the five times the lower seed has actually gone on to win the title as well. Two of those times it was the Heat choking. But still, when you look at it this way, you're seeing teams that shouldn't have the advantage get the advantage, and then makes it that much easier just to win one game, as opposed to the higher team only have to win two. In the subsequent 5 years, 2018 I'm not going to include because Cleveland couldn't even muster up the strength to get to a Game 5, but in the four previous matchups between Cleveland and Golden State, the home team won three of the times, which was Golden State those three times. The other time, Cleveland won. Well, each time a Game 5 has been won, it has been won by the team that has gone to win the title. Golden State won, you know, their three titles by winning their Game 5, two of which were in 5, the other one in 6, and then Cleveland started their big comeback by winning Game 5. Now, they had to go on the road, which was obviously much more difficult, but because they were able to win on the road, they had the advantage of playing the next game at home, help them, you know, bring that, have that comeback come even further. So that's the NBA breakdown. I also looked at MLB last 10 years as well, where MLB uses the 2-3-2, which we expressed our disdain for in the fall. Since 2009, there have been 27 series including a Game 5. That's only going to be the championship series in each league or the World Series. The home team is 19-9 in those 28 matchups. 19-9 is the home team. So 19 times the underdog, quote-unquote, has won. Now, in the series, 16 times has the underdog then gone on to win it. So 3 times, it did not make that much of a difference. But still, to go 19-9 when at home in that, you know, extremely pivotal Game 5, whenever the home team is the one that should be the team that has the advantage overall in the series, it's kind of as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, so to stay in Major League Baseball, I have a couple examples that are also similar to the NBA ones that I mentioned. In 2014, the Kansas City Royals had the home field advantage. Again, advantage in quotes. Series was tied 2-2 going into Game 5, which, of course, in this situation was in San Francisco. The Giants win. They end up taking the series in 7. And again, it comes down to the argument that that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a done deal. Winning Game 5 doesn't automatically win you the series when the series is tied 2-2, but it's the fact that at that point, the team that loses has to win the next two. There's no room for error, and you want to have that game in your building if you've earned that advantage. 2017, more recently, the Dodgers had home field. Series was tied 2-2. Game 5 was in Houston, even though the Dodgers should have had the home field advantage at this point. Houston wins and again takes the series in 7. So you're seeing examples where, although it's not, could have turned out differently or the same way depending on how you're looking at the breakdown of the series, you're seeing examples where this pivotal Game 5 for a team that should have it at home is on the road and it's in the long run costing them. From 2003 to 2012 in Major League Baseball, there have been 17 occurrences where there has been a 1-1 tie in a best-of-7 series following the first two games. In 10 of those series, it did not end up reaching 7 games, but 7 of those 10, the lower seed won. So you're seeing where you split. If you're the team that's at the disadvantage, you split on the road, come home for 3 straight, and it ultimately has shortened the series. And by shortening the series, it has been an advantage to the team that should not necessarily have the advantage based on location of the game. So I think there's several examples where the 2-3-2 is not necessarily beneficial. Now, where we're seeing a 2-2-1-1-1 work the way it's supposed to is in the National Hockey League, and there are a few examples of that in recent years. Starting in 2010, the Chicago Blackhawks had home ice in the finals against the Philadelphia Flyers. Series was tied 2-2. Game was in Chicago, where it should be for the team that has the advantage. They win at home, they win Game 6, and take the Stanley Cup. They did the same thing in 2013 against the Boston Bruins. They had home ice. The series was tied 2-2. Pivotal Game 5 was in their building, and they win it and ultimately win the Stanley Cup in 6 games. And as recently as 2017, the Penguins had home ice. Tied 2-2 against the Predators. They come home, win Game 5, ultimately win the Stanley Cup. So again, it's not necessarily a done deal based on who wins Game 5, but that's a pivotal game. As you mentioned, it becomes a best of 3 at that point, and you want to get off on the right foot. And it's hard to do that on the road and then come back home and have to face 2 elimination games in order to pull it out. Does it guarantee that it would change if it is in their building? No. Is it a guarantee that if the NHL had a 2-3-2, those teams would have lost on the road in Game 5? No. But it's home for a reason. Whether or not you think that's actually an advantage, the way that the playoffs are set up, it's designed to be an advantage, and it should be an advantage the whole way through. There should not be any point where the team that it performed poor in the regular season should have the advantage in any way, shape, or form. If we are seeding teams at home based on their performance, and the games are structured so that there are more at the venue of the better team, whether or not the home advantage exists, we are saying it does based on the way we've set things up. And for that reason, it has to be consistent so that the team that should get that quote-unquote advantage has it at all pivotal points in the series. Also in the NHL since 2010, there have been 5 times that the Stanley Cup final was tied 2-2. In those game 5s following the 2-2 tie, home teams are 4-1. Of the 4 teams that won, 3 of them ended up winning the Stanley Cup. It's a small sample size, and say what you want about it, but it proves the point that there is some substance to having that pivotal game 5 in your own building, and if that's an advantage, quote-unquote advantage, that you've earned, that's something that you should have throughout the postseason.
Yeah, definitely. The NHL absolutely does it right. You brought up some really great examples. I looked at throughout all 7 potential games that the home team can have. In those 7 games, Game 5 has the highest win percentage for home teams. Home teams are 387 and 216 in Game 5s. That's a 642 win percentage. Home teams win Game 5 in the NHL more often than they win Game 1. So whenever you have such an important pivotal Game 5, which clearly home ice matters in that a lot, and it matters so much that you want the team to have the advantage, and obviously the home team has it rightfully so in the NHL. In the NBA, NBA is one of the most despairing sports between home and away losses. You mentioned before last week how NBA, barely any team had positive records on the road in the regular season. It's about a 60% chance that the team that is home will win in the regular season. I believe that gets amplified to about 63% in the postseason. So whenever you have, you know, a 3 out of 5 chance to win at home and you're the lower seed, it works absolute wonders for you. Being the higher seed, you should have that favor in your path because, once again, being up 3-2 is a lot better than being down 2-3. It's just common sense. And for the fact that the NHL can do it right, it took so long for the NBA to finally adapt this. It was mostly because in the 80s, the Lakers and the Celtics were about 3,000 miles apart. So back whenever airfare was not as easy to accommodate as it was now, it was hard to fly teams back and forth between East and West Coast so often. That's why the 2-3-2 was adopted. Well, it's 2019. Obviously, they realized in 2013 that, hey, maybe this should change. It's about time that MLB changes it as well, because I saw an argument that, well, you can only use 2 pitchers. Well, I think you're allowed to be able to fly one day and play the game the next day. You don't have to have gaps in between each day. You don't have to take a day for flights because each team has to take the flight. So each team has the same advantage in that regard. We're advanced enough in technology that we can change this. We're changing most other aspects of MLB rules to make the game better, more fun, or whatever for fans. I don't care about all that crap. I'm more interested in, is it fair for the teams? Is it fair for the players? 2-3-2, in my opinion, not fair for the players. NHL and NBA show that the Game 5 matters tremendously. So that's my take on it all.
Yeah, and again, we can't stress enough that the point is not whether or not home field advantage is real. We, however, have put in place a system that says home advantage is real. And so to take it and put it in a situation where the team that should get the advantage doesn't have it the entire time doesn't make a whole lot of sense. A couple more things on your Game 5 points. In the NHL, Game 5 winners have a 72.8% chance to win the series. That's as of 2015. Obviously, that number has been updated.
Tremendous.
But that includes elimination games. The NBA, Game 5 winners take the series 82% of the time, and in Major League Baseball, since 85, we've had 28 2-2 ties, as you've talked about before, 64.3%. Game 5 winners win it all. So there is certainly something to be said about the momentum that Game 5 carries with it, where Game 5 takes place should not be up for debate.
No, absolutely not. So that was Uncorked. Thank you for following along.
Hopefully all that made sense.
Yeah, hopefully it maybe kind of resonates with you, changes your opinion a little bit. It resonates with us a lot. Anyway, lastly, we're going to conclude the show with quick picks where we have some important playoff matchups to talk about. We're going to start in the NHL. Yes, the game is going on right now, but we did make our pick before the game. It's Carolina at Washington. Even though I said Carolina in the series, I said Washington in this game because home team has won each game. Washington is very strong on home. It's just hard for Carolina because Washington has the experience. I'm going with the Caps.
My pick coming in was Hurricanes in 7, and although the home team has won, I'm going with the Hurricanes. There's something about this team. I believe in them, so go Canes. Stars at Blues, game 1 coming up, I believe, tomorrow. I'm going to go with the Dallas Stars. St. Louis was not great at home. Dallas was solid on the road in the first round. It's a battle of the defenses, and I think Ben Bishop's going to come out on top. I think the Stars get off to a good start.
Yeah, St. Louis had a poor track record at home in their first series. For that reason, I'm going to go with the Stars as well. Seemed to be just riding a little bit of a stronger wave, in my opinion. They had a more decisive victory over Nashville than St. Louis did over Winnipeg, so I'm going to go with Stars in game one of this series. Moving into the NBA, important game six, Denver at San Antonio. Don't want to go to a game seven. That's why I'm picking the Nuggets to win this one. It's going to win the series in six. That was my original prediction from the onset. Spurs are good, but Nuggets, I think, are just enough better. I'm going to go with Denver.
I picked Denver in seven, so I'm going to take the Spurs in this game six at home. Jazz at the Rockets in game five. I'm going to go with the Jazz to extend the series just a little bit longer. We talked about it earlier. I think Utah pulls it out.
I think Houston has this one in five. It's Harden against Mitchell. Harden has the advantage. Houston will win the series in five. Moving in across the ocean now to Champions League. It is soccer. It is semifinals, first leg occurring next Wednesday. Ajax and Tottenham is the first game. I'm going to go with a draw in this game. While the game is at home for Tottenham, I just think that they had such a tough victory over Manchester City that it will be tough to replicate that against Ajax. So I'm going to go with a draw in the first game.
I'm going to go with Ajax. Tottenham's defense has struggled a bit at times this year, and I think Ajax is equipped to take advantage of that, so I'm going to take Ajax. Liverpool at Barcelona. I'm going to go with Barcelona. Their goal differential is a plus nine. They've been a very solid team all year, very well-rounded. The offense can bring it. The defense, I believe, allows less than a goal per game, so I'm going to go with Barcelona.
I'm going to go with Barcelona as well. Messi is just playing as well as he usually does. They don't have to face Real Madrid this time. Seems to be Barcelona's Champions League to lose. I will go with them in the first leg at home. One baseball series for you is Cleveland at Houston. It's a four-game set this weekend. It's in Houston, but I'm going to go with Cleveland in three games over Houston here. No real reason, just I have a good feeling about Cleveland this one for some reason.
I'm going to go with Houston to take three. They are significantly better offensively, 7-1 at home. I'm going to go with the Astros. And we are going to go home, Chris, because that is all the time that we have for tonight. Be sure to join us next week for our final show of the season. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you next time.